You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
G'day and welcome to this week's Red Center podcast. I'm Mike Seymour, joined in a sunny Sydney, getting ready for a hot Christmas by Jason. How are you?
Hey Mike, how are you?
I'm good. You're going to be having a hot Christmas kind of feast?
Yes. Yeah, it's very weird for those in the Northern Hemisphere to understand the fact that you sort of all put fake snow everywhere and sit down to a hot roast dinner and on a 40-degree day. It's kind of weird here at Christmas in Australia.
Yes, but we have the added advantage of being able to sit around drinking cocktails by the pool.
Absolutely. Dangling your feet in the pool and, yes.
Yeah, lying around in the sun on that post, I've had too much turkey kind of fest. So in our own defence, we have a cracker of a show for you this week as we catch up with some Frankies. Both of them, and as well as some cool gear. Have a look at the AE Red plugin, which is a huge advantage thanks to John Montgomery in Chicago. And also look at a company that's producing a whole range of different footage around, I'll get to that later, basically stock footage shot on Red. But let's start the week, as we do always, with the news.
And now, the Red Setter News.
And Jason, I can get a Red pretty quickly now if I want one.
Yeah, 3 to 5 days. How long did you wait for yours when you ordered yours?
I waited a year and a half, but it wasn't released when I ordered mine. It was, from an NAB to September. That's fine. I don't have any problem with that.
3 to 5 days now, which is fabulous. I'm not going to bother doing the delivery schedule anymore in the news, but
we can leave that out from now on. But we can discuss the Red RAM.
Yes, Red RAM. Well, there's no news on that either. That is still... that's one of those things. I think it's probably the one sort of when is it going to turn up, apart from the Red Primes. It's probably one of the most eagerly anticipated bits of gear from Red. It's at the moment still in internal testing. It must really be a tricky fix. It must really be tricky to get this thing out the door. December 08 release, so we've only got a few weeks if you want one till they're going to get them out the door, I guess.
Yes. Well, yeah, now we have got big news in the fact that we have the R3Ds now in After Effects and Premiere, though I will be discussing that with some depth with John Montgomery coming later up in the show. So I'm going to skip over that in terms of news, other than to say that it's happened and it's very significant. But what you've discovered, which I thought was kind of fun, is the Frankie phenomenon. Do you want to explain to me about that?
Well, Frankie 1 was an original sort of test mule, I guess, an original prototype of Red 1. And I'll put links to this in the show notes for pictures of the old Red 1s. But essentially the news is that they've got the Super 35 Mysterium X up and running and got some fantastic photos, even if it's essentially just like dogs against black backgrounds, but it does look wonderful. It's nice to see that it actually, that, you know, they are actually, you know, getting on with this.
Well, now explain to me what those pictures are, because there's this picture of a literally bread box, like a wooden sort of thing, and there's also an amazing shot of the guys what looks like they're on a football field or something with...
Well, it started off as a post basically just saying 5K is alive and up and running, basically just saying, look, we're working on this, and there's some shots of essentially Frankie 2, which is the new Mysterium X circuitry and the sensor in the old original Red 1.
So this is like a test prototype unit?
This is the first sort of prototypes up and running, and there's a few shots of from it, essentially a few 5K shots, although they're only sort of half res here on the net.
So what are the shots of
somebody's dog? Just some shots of dogs against black, but I think it's basically just good to see that they're actually doing it and getting some images out of these things. And there is actually obviously some as we'd expect, there is some work going on in the background that they are actually apart from having doing wonderful renders of cameras to be, they are actually working on the guts of these cameras in the background. So it's great to see basically that they're working on it. There's renders coming, there's shots coming from it, and also as part of that they launched a few other photos of I guess, prototypes of the past, shots of what looks essentially like the original. Well, you could say it's the original Red One, the very first one. It's like, looks like the Apple One, the version of the Red.
Completely an old original sticker,
it's
like the original
Red logo.
It's a plywood
box with what looks like some sort of projector lens or something on the front of it, and like a big sort of huge computer cable coming out of the back of it. The very first Red One, I guess, and then some shots of... so essentially prototypes of Red One, and then a shot of, I guess, so this is Ted and Jim, and didn't recognize anybody else in that photo there, taking some shots on what probably would have been...
Can you see Jim in that shot? I can see Jared down the front.
Jared and Ted in the background looking very tense.
He's looking really tense, isn't he? But that was an old shot, right?
This is very, very first sort of few shots that were leaked even before they showed the Milk Girls. This is the on the drag strip. There was a shot of a dragster very early on.
Drag strip shots. Okay, now I know where you are.
Yeah. So that's just a shot on set, essentially, of the guys working away. Yeah, so it's quite interesting.
Now,
to see
when we had the Red One released, one of the big things was you could have it in two options. You could have uncompressed, or you could have it going to Red Code. And the idea was that the side CF card reader that I had was sold as standard in the early days, but you'd be able to replace it later with a direct feed out of the side of the camera that would give me uncompressed. And I was never hanging for that because I think, as you know, the R3Ds and the compression and the wavelet technology and stuff is one of the main reasons I bought a Red in the first place. But having said that, there were a lot of people that were interested in the uncompressed. And that's now resurfaced.
Yeah, you can get that if you want.
What's that going to cost me?
Jim's announced that it can do that if they get enough orders, pre-orders. I think they need 20 orders with a 50% deposit. That's no problem. If you want a Mysterium X S35 sensor, that will do 100 frames per second uncompressed, which will spit out a mere 2 gigabytes a second. That'll be $150,000. And if you want,
hang on. It's okay. Yep, go on.
Or you could option up. You could go to a Monstro full frame 35, 100 frames per second uncompressed, which it'll do a mere 4.8 gigasecond, and that's just $300,000. So
if they get 20,
no problem. Yep.
50% on the $300,000,
yep.
They'll build it.
Go ahead and build it.
So if you give them $3 million, they'll build this for you. Basically, is what you're saying.
Give me $3 million, I'll build it for you.
I don't have any problem with that. I mean, I would need some serious cash. These are not like the original deposits, right? These aren't like, give me the money, and if you don't like it, I'll give it back. These are non-refundables.
Absolutely. I think you're in the special club here.
You're in the special club.
Especially, I think, to be honest.
There could be, I don't know, military applications or somebody that...
Absolutely.
You know, if you're testing something that...
Well, the military have probably already done this. But it's probably the size of a car engine and costs $18 million. But you know what price? No option. You know,
right? Does it come with an indestructible ashtray for $4 million as a side order?
How would you write out 4.8 gigasecond? What would you record it to?
Oh, I'd probably.
Would you
be
get
using
that? Is that included?
I'd probably use an Amiga or an early Lisa.
Tape drive from a C64.
Yeah, 4.8 gigasec. Okay, that's a pretty decent data rate, and that would require some serious striping to be able to record that down.
Yeah.
I guess this, if nothing else, in all seriousness, does point to the fact that this is what we'd be dealing with if we didn't have Redcode.
Yeah.
That we'd actually be dealing with a camera that would have another $300,000 added to the price,
yeah.
And it would require a fridge to be carried along behind it on rollers to record the data.
I think it's basically saying, you know, pay up or put up or shut up, you know. Basically silencing the people that who really want it. Look, yeah, you can have it, you know, just gather a few friends together and we will do this, no problem. But obviously what's core to this post is saying that,
look, you realize that
we don't think it's necessary. Redcode is fantastic or will be fantastic. You won't need it.
At 4.8 gigasecond, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you were filming with that, you would get 1 3.5-minute take per terabyte.
Right. Okay.
If my math doesn't fail me.
So how much is that a frame then?
Well, it's 4.8 gig divided by I'm assuming we're shooting at 24 frames a second. So, you know, I guess it's what?
No, that's 100. That's if you're running at 100 frames a second then. Is that at 4.8 gigasecond? Is it 100 frames?
I don't know about that, yeah.
Or is that at 25?
Good point.
We should ask. We should check before we...
I don't want to indicate that I have any interest in giving him $300,000.
We should check before we put the money down, maybe.
Yeah. I think, as I said, the interesting takeout from that is more like what we are saving by having Redcode.
Yeah.
And please send Christmas cards to, you know, Graham Natras, I think it'd be my takeout from that, rather than I need to fork out the $300,000.
And just wait, also, and just wait and see what Redcode 225, 500 will do before we, you know, put your money down for the uncompressed version.
I really think you would need some kind of military and or scientific justification to want to do that. I can't imagine it being a filmmaking criteria that would make you want to do that.
Yeah,
But yeah, that's fine. I mean, you know, there are particularly legitimate reasons why you want to have high speed photography of highly detailed things. I mean, if you're trying to make a car safer, but if you're trying to do an analysis of a car, it was going to save somebody's lives, and it was a major research center, then maybe 3 minutes is nothing to balk at.
Sure.
And I don't have any problem with them doing that. I just can't see it as a filmmaking imperative.
Uncompressed imperative, I can't see. You know, you'll be able to get 100. You'll be able to get 100 frames a second out of the red ones, out of the Monstro. You know, out of the Epics when they come, but there'll be a little bit of compression. Not that you'll be able to see it. Basically, just saying, wait and see.
Totally.
We can do it if you want, but yeah, I wonder if they'll get any orders.
So, any other news before we move to the groove of gear?
No, that's it.
And now, the Red Setter Gear Guide.
So in the gear market, you've come across, I think, a really interesting thing. I was waiting for this. This is the monster cable, to one of you use an analogy solution, right?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting sort of setup here for audio, for getting audio out of the Red One to, say, you know, to a hard disk recorder, or getting it out to your sound guy, and making it easy to plug it in and also easy to move the camera around. This is essentially a cable from a company called Filmuloid, and it's basically got two mini XLRs and a headphone jack. And it all goes down into one cable, one 10-foot cable, and at the other end is two XLRs for the audio out and two RCAs for the audio in. Not quite sure where you'd want to have the sort of feedback from the camera, maybe just for sort of checking, just for sort of confidence, just to check that the audio is going in correctly. And obviously the fantastic thing about it, in the middle of it, it just basically has one breakaway section in the middle to, if you're relocating the camera, you don't have to unplug four connections or three or four connections. You just break the one connection in the middle and they can move the camera around. Then when it's back in position, you just click it back up again and the sound department is connected again to the audio department.
The only thing I think the breakout boxes are now almost standard by most people that are using them.
Yeah, that's true, but that doesn't handle the audio, does it?
No, it can if you've got the bigger ones.
I've never seen one of those yet. Yeah,
I think, Element Technica stuff tends to be the smaller stuff, and that's probably the most popular one on the market.
Yeah, what I've seen, and that really just handles the SDI side of things. Mm. So this is a great solution for the sound guy, and it means that you don't have to be the bunny to go up to the camera and unplug it all the time. That's one cable that, you know, you can leave to camera department, and then you can just go and plug it in one move later on. So that is $375 Canadian, and you go to just Google Filmuloid, and also again in the show notes we will put a link to their site. Now Mike's playing with my a little toy I've had for years, which leads us to the next bit of gear. Now this is essentially probably what every DP should have in their kit, or probably already does if you're out there working. This is SunPath make, Filmtools make a bit of software called SunPath, sun tracking software. Now, if you want to find out where the sun's going to be a specific time, if you're out there in a recce at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you want to be there, say, between two buildings, and you want to know when's the sun going to come through this area and backlight this spot where we're standing at, in 2 days' time, when is that going to be the optimum time to be in this shot? When do we need to be here? Or when's the...
So if this you're is the standing, really cool stuff that I see on some call sheets where I go, how the hell did they work that out?
Yeah. Or if you're standing on a beach and you want to know, look, where's the sun going to come up, you know, in 2 weeks' time or in a month's time? If you're standing on a city street, when are we actually going to get sun in this area? So basically be able to predict the sun and where it's going to come, you need two pieces of gear. First of all, you need this SunPath software, which is fantastic. And as I say, it's a bit of an industry staple. What you do is essentially you'll enter in your country, where you're going to be, and you can enter any sort of city or zip code all around the world. Enter the time of day, or enter the date, rather. You can even give it a week, and it will essentially give you a graph. Now, Mike, you're a math head. You can look at that graph, and that makes sense to you, doesn't it?
It makes complete sense. It's the angle of the sun in the sky, and, of course, it also has basic stuff like, I happen to know from this one that you've printed out that that sunrise on Christmas morning will be at 5:44 a.m., which is to say that's when I'll be getting up, because that's when my children will be getting up.
That's when the kids are going to wake you up.
And that I'll be going to sunset at 8:07, which is about 1 minute later that I'll be fast asleep on the ground, kind of passed out from Christmas Day.
Ah, summer in Sydney. The sun's up at 4 and doesn't go to bed till 8. Brilliant.
It's up at 5:44, yes. So it's up at 5 and down at 8. And there you go, that's a good sunny day. But also, as you say, it's got the angle that the sun will be in the sky, because, of course, it's not just that it goes straight up overhead. And
exactly. Now, when you've got that, the next bit of kit you need to be able to interpret that and to sort of make sense of that when you're out on set with this. So essentially, you can put that into your computer and then print it out. And you don't need to take your laptop. You don't need to take anything with you.
Yeah,
you can just
take one sheet
of paper, and everyone can have that, and you can walk around. But maybe don't give it to everyone, because
that's bloody useful when we're shooting.
It's a very specific thing. You keep that to yourself. It's a very specific thing. Makes you look very impressive.
Clearly.
Wander around with this little thing that's your own little sort of...
But that's only part one of what you found. What's
exactly
the other part that you...
So then you need the Sunto, or the Sunto make compasses. Most people know they make sort of, you know, jogging GPS watches and all that sort of stuff. But they make something called a Sunto Tandem, which is an inclinometer and a compass in one. And now this is not just a compass or an inclinometer, but they're a sighting compass and a sighting inclinometer. Basically, Mike, did you look through it? And you look through the hole.
No, I was looking at the wrong. I was looking through the lens.
You look through the little hole there, and now what you can see is essentially an angle of tilt. Okay, so
I can work it now. I'm holding it around the right way.
Now, if you open your other eye,
can I just point out that the guy in the picture that you've got in the show notes is holding it differently.
He is, but he's essentially doing the same thing. So what you're doing is you have one eye up to the little eyepiece on the inclinometer, and you keep the other eye open. Okay, now if you look up, say if you want to look at the top of that building over there, you can look up and see, it's hard to sort of podcast and look through an inclinometer and talk and think.
No, I'm doing it.
I'm sure.
Yes, that building is
so you
30
can
degrees
say,
up.
30 degrees up, right, okay. Now what you've also got then, if you then turn it on its side, it's a compass, it's a sighting compass. There's another viewfinder on the bottom there, and you can look through there and see what degrees.
Okay, so the building
that is a little bit clunky. It's a bit old. It does need a bit of a service.
No,
it's not working very well.
It's 180 degrees.
Right. Okay.
So that would be due south.
Okay. So then you can look on your little sheet here, and if it says the sun's going to come up at what? So where does it say this? What degree of on the compass point does it say that the sun's going to rise? It should be maybe on the bottom, is it?
At 228 degrees.
Right, so 228, okay.
That's sunset, sorry. Sunrise is 107.
Right, okay. So basically, you could, at any sort of point along the line there, you get a little dot saying, this is at 11 a.m., it's going to be here. At 12 p.m., it's going to be, you know, 70 degrees and 150. So at any point in the arc of the sky, basically lets you track the sun through the arc of the sky, and will let you know if you've got a percent. And what you can obviously do on these charts is actually draw your buildings. If you can actually map it, you can actually sight the building and know that it's 30 degrees, so you can actually draw a line along 30 degrees there and know that the sun's not going to come over that thing until, you know, 8 a.m. or whatever
it is. In this case, 8:15. That is brilliant, man.
Right. So, essentially...
God, I could so have used this the other day when we were shooting that.
Right. Excellent. So, now, SunPath sell the software alone for $99, or they also sell the Sunto Tandems for $255, or they have a combo deal where you can buy the software and the tandem together. Now, anything with all of these compasses is that they... Compasses are like have a region code, kind of like DVDs. Like a compass you buy in Southern Hemisphere doesn't work very well in Northern Hemisphere. So,
because it's adjusted for magnetic variance?
Yes, it's adjusted for actually the way the needle tilts, that somehow, not just how it points, but
is this
also
one of those toilet bowls going round.
It is one of those. It is one of those things that essentially sometimes a compass that, although it'll point and tell you the right north, it's sometimes the actual angle of the needle will be so that it'll actually jam and it won't swing properly and it won't read properly. So you have to buy the compass to suit your right region.
So don't buy it off eBay, buy it off Amazon.
Well, just on their site or on probably on SunPath's site, it will show you what the regions are and so you can choose the right one for where you're going to shoot. And if you're going to shoot Southern Hemisphere, maybe you need to buy two or three of these. But basically, it's a fantastic kit. Just put it in a pouch, keep it in your bag, and it's a brilliant sort of piece of kit. And you know, it's one of those when things when you whip it out on a recce and everyone goes, oh, impressive,
gadget envy.
So that's that. That's the gear.
Oh, cool. I have seen the former and not the latter. I've seen the call sheet version of, you know, when the sunrise is, and that's been I've never actually understood what the other thing was.
Right.
Clearly by the fact that I didn't actually hold it up correctly when I was trying to do a reading, but you know.
Yeah. No, it's a great little tool. Right. So to find out more, go to Widescreen Software, wide-screen.com, and you can find out more.
Okay. So, excuse me. So now we're going to shift gears and move to post-production issues. And firstly, I guess, without a doubt, after getting Final Cut running, the two biggies that we've been looking for in the industry, or maybe three, are Avid to do full support of R3Ds.
Still waiting.
Adobe After Effects-y, not After Effects per se, but After Effects and Premiere and stuff, to adopt full R3D workflow. And that's been hinted at for now months, and in my case I'm also looking for Autodesk to buy in so we can do finishing and stuff with smoke and things using R3D files. And the good news is that we have got the After Effects stuff running, or the Adobe stuff running, and it's kind of I think with all of these things, just as we discussed when we talked about the Final Cut Pro version, it takes a moment, if not a week, to do some serious work with it, to get past the brochure and get to a point where you can sort of definitively say, you know, I should use this or I shouldn't. If you remember when we were doing the stuff on Final Cut Pro, I was saying, look, I actually found some of the gotchas in this workflow to be actually enough to me to not recommend it. So last week we discussed that this was out, but I didn't want to get into it and just do a brochure-level discussion. What we did is speak to John Montgomery, and I think this is his first time on Red Center.
It could be.
I'll ask him.
Oh, maybe.
And because he knows a lot of people at Adobe, he's also very familiar with Red Workflow, having done major projects in Chicago with it. And, of course, one of the co-founders of FX Guide. So he's somebody we really trust. And we said, can you just kind of break it apart and see where it actually stacks up and whether or not you could recommend it? So we might cross over to an interview I did just before with John, discussing the Adobe implementation of R3D. So, John, hello, how are you?
Oh, fantastic, my friend. Happy holidays.
Is this the first time we've had you on Red Center?
I believe it is the first time I've been on, and quite excited. I'm new to this podcasting world.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah, my streams are crossing, the beams are crossing. You're on the wrong podcast. But hey, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about Red running in the After Effects environment. You've got it up and running and had a chance to play with it?
I do have it up and running, and it's quite interesting. I think one of the more interesting parts, actually, and surprising in my case because I don't use it as much, is its use in Premiere Pro. The implementation is actually quite good, just being able to drag, you know, once you get things set up correctly, your R3D files in your project with audio and so forth, and have decent playback, or I should say at least 1K playback on my 8-core Mac, it's actually really quite slick. I find the QuickTime proxies quite easy to use in Final Cut, but, you know, if you're just using the original R3Ds themselves without even worrying about the proxies, I think that's pretty cool.
Well, now, the trick of the R3Ds is that they have access to changes in the metadata, so I could change the ISO and stuff that I obviously couldn't do if I was just using the QuickTime proxy. So how much control do I have of metadata stuff in the Adobe implementation?
Well, let's just say one would think that, wouldn't they? And the reality is, in fact, that you don't have that capability accessing directly with the R3Ds within Premiere. It's quite interesting, actually. If you take and compare, for instance, a good test to do would be to import the R3D file and then say compare it against the medium-sized proxy, right, coming from the R3D. Mm-hmm. And if you compare those two, they're really just in, especially examining on the screen and doing some grading, actually dead nuts close to each other, okay?
Almost a perfect match.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think about those two things, the difference being that, you know, that in Red Alert, you have the capability to make adjustments and regenerate those QuickTime proxies. Right. I mean, a nice little feature that you have in that. The problem is that that works for the proxies, but not for the R3D file. It does not appear to be accessing that, you know, say could maybe access the .rsx file, but it doesn't. You just get the same thing. And it appears, at least from our testing, we've tried to get some confirmation from the folks at Red and Adobe and still waiting to hear back at this current moment regarding that. But it appears to just be effectively always using the metadata that's part, the original metadata that's recorded in the R3D file.
Now, that's a little bit disappointing, but is it giving me something else that is to die for, like 4K? Or because obviously you can't get 4K from the proxies in, say, Final Cut.
Well, you can actually have access to that through the Adobe products. Actually, in After Effects, what's really cool is you can go directly from a sequence in Premiere Pro, import it either through Dynamic Link or a project import into After Effects, where you can get 4K. And, of course, all the information in that Dynamic Link translates correctly. So there's no jumping through hoops. We have hoops available going from Final Cut to After Effects, right? Because you have, you know, automatic duck and so forth. But this is really an integrated solution in getting between the two products. But one thing I just want to take a step back and talk about, and that I found actually confusing and maybe will help others when they start out working with this, are the R3D source settings that you have within mm-hmm. Premiere Pro, okay? You open it up, and there's a pop-up where the top says format, and you have 4K, 3K, and 2K. And when I first started working with the plugin, I thought, okay, this is where I set up whether I'm going to work in 4K, 3K, or 2K, or 1K, whatever. That's not actually the case. Each of those pop-up lists in the format is how that format is treated, okay? So let's suppose that I want to work at 1K. In, you know, say a Mac that has some decent horsepower. Basically, what you need to go through is you need to set 4K to quarter resolution, okay? 2K to half resolution. And that basically what it's telling is this is how it's interpreting that original source material so that you bring it in and actually gets brought in at the appropriate resolution in your file. So that can be a little bit confusing at first. The next thing, and again, think of this as an early implementation, an early beta, is to have those settings stick, you actually need to quit and restart Premiere Pro.
Oh, really?
To have those applications take effect.
That's a nice gotcha.
So yeah, it is a nice gotcha. But I mean, you know, I mean, in fairness, this is, though a lot of the Red software and stuff comes out, is always beta, I guess. This is a very new implementation, and they kind of wanted to get it in the hands of people to start working with and banging on and seeing what they're getting into. But along with that, as you bring it in, you have things like you can set your various quality of what you're doing, the chroma denoise, debayering detail, you know, OLPF compensation and so forth. So you do have those settings, but again, those settings dependent upon when you start Premiere Pro. So if you make change, you have to quit and then restart again.
Do we know?
They actually suggest not finishing projects bigger than, say, 1K in Premiere Pro, and instead go ahead and doing the render in After Effects. Just apparently it's going to work a little bit better for you as far as performance. But I got pretty good performance, good, really full, high-quality 1K performance on this 8-core. Doing the highest quality 2K was causing it to choke on my 8-core Mac Pro, but bumping down the quality on that, I was able to get real-time performance at 2K in Premiere Pro. So somewhat analogous, I would say, don't you think, to what you can experience in Final Cut with QuickTime proxies?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do we know if the implementation that Adobe is using, because we saw them issue a press release at IBC about a relationship with Assimilate, do we know if they're using the SDK that's been put out by Red, or were they actually accessing the R3Ds directly?
Well, no, we don't know to start out. Actually contacted them to find out about that and haven't heard back regarding that either. But in looking at it, it seems as though, I mean, I'm guessing they're using aspects of the SDK the way you have access to it, because you're not, I don't know, at least the controls are the kind of closed controls that you would expect from an application such as Scratch that has the direct access. I don't see those controls directly in either After Effects or Premiere. Hopefully in an upcoming Red Center, we'll be able to talk more about that and once we get an answer back from them. But it appears as though, I don't know, my guess is that at least they're not using the full amount of the direct support if they are using that, you know. They're exposing very little of it to the end user.
And in terms of dealing with colour spaces, you know, one of the big things about Red is that not only does it have Rec 709 as a colour space, but it has its own colour spaces. Do we have an environment where we can work with the Red space, colour space in, say, After Effects, or am I limited to...
At this point, it seems to be limited to the Rec 709. In fact, we had a discussion, and I was discussing with Mark Christensen, who you know, of course, about this ahead of time. And the suggestion is actually in After Effects that if you want them to look like they look like in Premiere, is to actually, if you're using color management in After Effects, is to assign the HDTV, the Rec 709 color profile in the color management tab. But actually, both Mark and I on the release version of software and the release version of 901 found that actually not to be the case. That if you want the footage to look the same in After Effects as you are using in Premiere Pro, you just have to do it as Preserve RGB. But on top of that, no, you don't have access to those other settings. And I honestly hope that you would at some point. I guess in my thinking, what I would like to see is just kind of like what I'd like to see in Final Cut Pro, and that's access to all the things that you have in Red Alert available to you in After Effects. Because if you're going to do finishing or something in Premiere Pro or After Effects, I want to have all those controls to make sure that I've got the image optimized the way I wanted and not necessarily linked to what was set by the camera metadata. Because, I mean, as you know, just a different setting in the ISO on set, you may have that detail available to you, or you may have something available to you, but you're just not going to see it.
So it's a giant leap forward, but not exactly a moon base. It's not... We're not fully there yet.
No, and it's kind of giving you the same thing that you get, in at least in my opinion, Final Cut. It's a first version. You're seeing the promise, especially as I mentioned, if you're doing a cut in Premiere and then wanting to take it right in After Effects. I was using some of the footage that we're using in the After Effects course at PhD this term, and my thought about prepping those files for what we're doing and working with it, I could really see how it would be a fantastic thing to have this kind of workflow in Premiere, enough to make me want to start using Premiere for certain things if I was leading into effects job in After Effects. But honestly, in this case, I'd have to say that it's not there. Another thing I want to mention is that within After Effects, you're always going to be dealing with the 4K files in After Effects. So you can reduce the resolution interactively while you're working by setting your composition viewing to half resolution. But just dragging along the project, it seems to me as though the response that I'm getting from dragging along the R3D at 4K, effectively the native of what we shot, is slower than had I just simply exported 4K TIFF files.
Oh, really? Because it's doing some decoding and stuff.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. So I found that if you're going to, you know, in our... from my standpoint of doing scene-based effects, right, I'm going to want it to be very fast within scene, and maybe it's not going to be a really long scene, so I might as well go ahead and export a sequence of 16-bit TIFF files if I got the disk space, because actually the interactivity will be better than dragging along within a timeline the native R3D files, especially if you have multiple R3D files in a composition. It's going to have to do that debayering on the fly for all those layers, and at 4K, as you can imagine, it can be quite intensive.
Yeah.
So, I will. The other thing, not to be totally naive, the multiprocessor performance on Adobe Premiere is fantastic on
really?
The R3D playback. Hmm. Yeah. When you switch from low resolution to medium up to higher, you can see all the processors just peaking individually. So all eight of them are going, whether it's 25%, 50%, 75%, or 100%, really very nice distribution across the eight processors. So within the Premiere environment, they did a very nice job of optimizing the plugin and taking a look at it. In After Effects, not so much. It's a little less. You can see as you're dragging along in After Effects, you can see individual processors spike, not in the same way that's dealt with in Premiere. But of course, I think Premiere at root is probably more of a real-time playback performance app than After Effects would be. So,
well, look,
anyway,
you know,
some good stuff, some bad stuff, but I'm glad that it's out there and getting into more applications, you know?
Maybe when you've had a bit more time with it and we've answered some more of those questions, we could look at maybe a tip for FX Guide TV or something. We can have a look at some of the things that you're talking about. But we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us today. Thanks.
Hey, well, thanks so much, Mike. Glad I could help out.
Well, cool. It'd be great to get John back and answer some of those questions once we know more.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's a thing. We didn't want to wait until after Christmas to put this out. We wanted to have a good you know, run at it before we obviously spoke, as I said before. But yeah, we didn't want to have to wait till we got absolutely every answer. And so John is totally on it, and the guys are being really helpful. So he will get those answers, I'm sure.
That's great that Adobe's jumping on board with all of this and with a fervor, it seems.
Well, remember I mentioned in that interview that they did that deal with Assimilate, so it will be interesting to see whether they have a above par implementation of the R3D, as in fact Assimilate does, because Assimilate directly processes the R3Ds as opposed to using the SDK, but we just don't know.
Because After Effects is really, it's a very valuable, I mean, I don't really use it, but it's a very valuable tool for you guys, isn't it? It's used totally. On all levels, isn't it?
Especially in commercials and, you know, general broadcast design stuff,
but
totally.
Big post houses, everyone uses it, don't they?
Oh, yeah, totally. So we'll be good to see.
Okay.
Okay, so when we come back from the break, we hope to be doing a whole series more on post-production stuff. I hope this afternoon, in fact, to be going over to look at a new Coda box running with R3Ds. So we'll get you that in the new year, which will be good. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that is going to be rolling out between now and NAB in particular. I just don't think they can help but leak. So that'll be good.
Excellent. Okay.
Now, in terms of Red Rooms, because we've now caught up with our, you know, November, whatever it was, announcements, and our December 3rd announcements, and our, we can actually get back to sitting down with some actual people that are shooting footage.
So apologies to Phil Bates from Artbeats. I did do this interview a little while back, but yes, with the recent Red announcements and things, we've sort of, Red Room got put on the back burner a little bit. But yeah, speaking to Phil Bates, who although it's not too long ago, was at that stage just about to launch the Red section, Border Red, and was implementing a whole bunch of Red, basically adding a Red side to his business. It's a stock footage library, if you don't know Artbeats. One of the things that they're famous for is their film damage series, which is a whole bunch of effects and light leaks and flashes and dirt and stuff, which people have used for years to make video look like film.
And they have a really good HD cloud collection as well, like aerials and stuff, which I've used the cloud stuff, the HD stuff a lot.
Right. So, yeah, now he's basically launching a Red side, a 4K side to the business, so you can go and download footage from Red all the way from SD versions of it right up to actually being able to get your hands on the R3D files. So here's Phil.
You can actually buy the R3Ds?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. I thought they were just giving out the footage. Oh, that's really interesting. That's significant.
Yeah, that's... Well, they'll take it all the way up to HD, and then also that as a special side, you can actually get the R3Ds if need be. They do a lot of treatment to their stuff, which is all good. No, don't take anything too far, but they'll sort of essentially do cleanups or stabilizations and things to for the HD versions. But yes, essentially, it's like for stock footage, it's like being able to get, you know, as I say in the interview, it's like getting the neg.
Oh, cool. Well, that is really interesting. I look forward to that.
Okay, so here's Phil. Okay, I'm speaking today with Phil Bates, the CEO of Artbeats, the fantastic online stock footage library.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Maybe we'll just start off with the Artbeats story, I guess, for people that don't know the company.
Sure. We started... Artbeats started doing still images back in 1989, and then moved on to video and footage in 1996, and really started out with our special effects, a lot of pyrotechnics, fire, smoke and explosion, that kind of thing. And we built our library from there, and so we're over 10 years building our footage library and making a name for ourselves in the stock footage business.
Probably a lot of our listeners may know of you for your film clutter reel, because it's so widely used in making non-film footage look like film.
That's probably one of our most successful titles, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah. And in fact, the Film Clutter Volume 2, we had a lot of fun with that. And we tried to figure out all kinds of ways to mark up film and scrape it and scratch it, and I even tied a piece of film to the back of my van and drove it around town for a couple of miles and then sent it off to the lab and told them, you know, this is going to be a little bit dirty, but, you know, so you might want to do it at the end of the batch. But, film clutter, the good thing about film clutter is that it's very generic and it can be used almost anything. And from music videos to, you know, a healthcare commercial, it doesn't really matter. So that's, you're right. It's a very, very usable product and been very successful.
Now you've since purchased a Red and shooting a lot of footage, I guess, for that.
Yeah, and I can't seem to figure out a way to do film clutter with that because everything comes out so clean on it. So anyway, yes, we have received our Red. We ordered Red number 1168. Was our number. We ordered it in January of 07 and took our delivery in April of 08, so just April this year. And that was right about NAB, and it took us a while to get it up and running. And so we've been shooting fairly constantly since June, okay. Mostly nature subjects.
Fantastic. So there's plenty of that footage up there now on the site?
That's right. That'll be right there, so your timing is good.
Fantastic. So what's your role when you're shooting? I mean, are you the DP or?
Yeah, I'm the director and DP. We're kind of casual. I usually take a couple other people just because it is kind of a bulky piece of equipment. We like to be fairly spontaneous, and so we need to move quickly. So it's helpful to have a couple of people there. I have a camera assistant and just a general assistant who helps me with logging shots as we shoot them. And
so obviously you're used to like hiking up mountains with this stuff. You've probably got a fairly lightweight package.
Right. We actually have keep everything in packs that are we can put on our backs. And we've hiked up and down hills and things to get where we need to go. So, yeah, that's been a good exercise, actually.
Now, you probably do a lot of local shooting around where you are.
Yeah, being in Southern Oregon, we are in a very beautiful place. So, yeah, yes, there's a lot to shoot here. And we've shot around here, but also gone up north to the Olympic Peninsula, gone south to Lassen Park, and then we just came back from a trip to Wyoming to Jackson Hole. So other than here, we do try to get around.
Must be very relaxing, very good for the soul, wandering around, just waiting for the right light and sitting on very, very quiet mountains looking for the right light and right shot.
That's right. There is that element, but there's also the element of stress in that you really want that light to come and you don't want it to take forever because you're paying these people and you only have a couple of days. And I wish it was all that relaxing. And when we're doing time-lapse shots, that's nice and relaxing because we just can't do anything while that's going on. But it's still enjoyable to be out there in the countryside. I don't want to make it sound like it's too hair-raising, but it is enjoyable, and I enjoy being out in nature and finding just the right shots. There's just a feeling of anticipation and excitement that I get. I go, oh, the light's good today, and can we get everything done by the time a magic hour hits? And, you know.
No real gotchas with the time-lapse? Because I really haven't talked to many people about time-lapse functions, really, on the show.
Yeah, well, actually, it's fairly simple to switch over to the time-lapse mode. And
all right, then. So what other gear have you got with it? What do you choose to hike up the mountain with?
Well, when we got the camera, we got it with a PL mount. But the PL lens, as you probably well know after all your podcasts you've been doing, is pretty sparse right now. And we felt that for what we needed to do, we needed more lens options. So we just went ahead and put the Nikon mount on it. And for the kind of shooting we're doing outdoors, mostly static shots, tilts and pans, it works for us. So we went ahead and, you know, bought a full set of Nikon professional zooms, and I think I should probably get some primes, but we just got the zooms for now, and they're very sharp. They work really well. And so we got that. We got the full set of, you know, the batteries, the CF cards, three Red drives.
Actually, at the moment, we're doing a bit of a series on tripods and tripod choice. People might be interested what tripod you've chosen to lug halfway up a mesa.
Well, we use the Sackler Video 25.
Right.
It's a tripod we had for the F900 because we purchased an F900 2 years ago. By the way, do you know anybody who wants to buy a used F900?
So what format is the footage available online?
We're taking the R3D files, converting them to photo JPEG QuickTime movie files in their native resolution. So if it's shot at 4K, we offer a 4K QuickTime photo JPEG file, and it'll be cleaned up and color corrected and all that kind of thing, of course. And also, we'll take that 4K file and we'll make the HD, SD, you know, PAL and NTSC and low res versions as well out of that 4K file. So we'll crop. We might even do some camera moves for those files, because with 4K, you've got all this wonderful pixel real estate that you can do that kind of thing with. And in addition, we will provide the R3D file for an upgrade fee of $100.
Fantastic.
And we are, as far as we know, and we've done a lot of research, looked up all the other websites, stock footage websites, we're the only ones who are offering RED footage as royalty-free footage.
And that's great, being able to get the R3D if you need. I mean, that's like being able to ship someone the NEG.
Yeah, it's very much like a NEG.
Okay, so what's your preferred post path to process the footage?
We take it off the hard drive, the source hard drive, RED hard drive, because we have not been using CF cards. We've been using the RED drive. And put it onto our server farm, and we make selects. And so once we make selects off of what we really want, we'll open up each of those files. We'll do color correction in RED Alert. And then we'll use RED Rushes to process. Actually, we output to DPX. It takes a third less space or a quarter less space than TIFF, so, and not much quality loss, so we like DPX. Then we take each of those DPX sequences and import them into After Effects, and I do a secondary color correction and any kind of masking, or if it's time lapse, I may adjust the time, squeeze the time, or do any cropping or stabilization fixes or anything like that. I do all that in After Effects. We have two keyworders on full-time staff here that are just keywording all the clips that we get put up on the website. So, and then we output as photo JPEG and put it on the website.
We talked about what you didn't like about the RED One. What do you like about it coming from, I guess, F950 and obviously film as well?
Well, we're really all about quality here. And years ago, it was all 35mm film, and then we accepted the F900 as being close enough. But the RED, it just brings a whole new dimension with the larger pixel area. That's obviously really big for us. The artifacts that we have with the F900, like some of the ringing and the edge artifacts, and also the clipping that we see, even when you use the knee on the F900, there's still some clipping with the red, green, and blue channels on the higher end, like if you're shooting a sunset. And the RED seems to not only have a little bit more range, dynamic range, but also it has a better roll-off instead of just clipping. It's got a better roll-off on those higher ends, so it looks more organic and more film-like. So image quality is very big for me. The way it looks on the field, to be able to have that histogram right there, and it's bright enough to use outside, we have no problem with that. And we're able to feel fairly confident about focus. I wish it was as easy as an F900 with an ENG lens, where, you know, all in one package. The RED is a little bit bulkier to use, and we're changing lenses constantly. So I would rather be more ENG like. But other than that, really good quality and good ease of use out in the field.
Well, thanks, Phil. That's fantastic. Thank you for taking the time today.
Glad to be part of this. That's great.
So anybody with RED footage, how do they go about submitting it to ArtBeats?
The best thing to do is to come to our website and go to the bottom where it says Contact Us. And on that page, you'll find footage submission guidelines and an email address. You can click on it and send Wanda a description of what you got, and we'll talk further.
Thanks again, Phil, for your time. That's brilliant. Yeah, I'm sure everyone can go and check it out and go and buy Film Clutter too.
Yeah, that's right.
Cheers, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, it doesn't matter how many people we talk to that are actually out. I just never get sick of hearing people shooting with the RED stories. You know what I mean? Like, it's just great.
Yeah. So, look, actually, if you've got a RED and you think you've got an interesting story. One thing we're trying to talk to is some people who've actually shot underwater with it. There seems to be a bit of a limit to people who have actually taken them underwater. There's a guy in Sydney I'm trying to speak to, but also, yeah, if you've taken it underground, space, wherever, inside a mountain, whatever.
If you have a private space program or a large...
If you've
actually taken it onto the wreckage of the Titanic
exactly.
In a motorized mini geek, then please contact Jace.
If you've got an interesting red story, I'd love to speak to you. So, just listen to the end for the links of how to get in touch.
So this winds up our Christmas edition. It's been a good year, I think, for Red. I mean, if we think about what we've seen over the year.
Yeah, very busy. And a lot of changes from what we sort of essentially saw right through from, I guess, NAB at the beginning of the year.
I think we've matured in the camera from what would have to be described as late-stage beta to a release. I mean, 16 was a release for me.
Yeah.
There's been a bunch of interesting stuff that's happened along the way, and then there's been this whole second tier of what's coming down the pipe, which is...
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be, for next year, there's going to be a lot of... we should start to see these cameras we've been talking about, the Scarlett and Epic. We should actually start to, maybe by the end of... by sometime during next year, we should actually start to see this stuff becoming a reality.
Very much so, because I think, you know, my expectation certainly is that, notwithstanding what they've said, I imagine that they're going to see some really good stuff at NAB.
Yep.
Everyone will be really keen to see what that looks like. There'll be a couple of surprises at NAB. I can't believe they won't keep at least a couple of things up their sleeve.
Absolutely.
And then we'll see stuff shipping, you know,
should see
a quarter or so after that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, in between time, while there's essentially probably going to be some dead space probably on the Red scene, we'll keep the show interesting with not just Red related stuff, but, you know, on-set stuff and rat holes, and talking to, as we talked about a couple of episodes ago, we'll talk to crew in general and just talk about the whole on-set and filmmaking in general, and not just how it relates to Red.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got some tests that I want to show you. I'm actually going to think I put them in a tip for FX Guide TV coming out before the end of the year, I think in episode about 49, because I did some tests during the week of shooting green screen, both daylight and tungsten, IR 50, and I actually went up to IR 72. This is with Pete Holland. And then what was interesting about it is we shot all these key tests, both daylight and tungsten, and then we did an ADB filter in front of the lens to see if the green screen would be as equally keyable,
right,
if we then, you know, basically were balancing in filter as opposed to balancing on color temperature of the lights.
Mm.
And rather than just go through all that now, which is actually kind of pretty hard to do without some pictures, I'm going to put that up in an FX guide tip. So keep an lookout for that.
Fantastic.
But bottom line is, what we've been saying, I found to be exactly true. It's We reinforced what we knew rather than had dramatic surprises, but it was really interesting, some of the differences that we saw. So
right,
check that out. But certainly, it's just fun doing control testing. Like, it's fun when you kind of go, all right, I think this to be the case, but we should actually have a look at this for real, and then you start getting into it.
Because what you're doing is actually what you might do for a show, but in a much more relaxed environment. If you were going to do the test before an actual shoot, you'd probably be rushed and pushed, and, you know, would sort of have to make a bit of a quick, uncalculated guesstimate, you know, in the heat of the moment of what, which is the best way to go. But you're actually, it's great to actually have the time that you're doing to do it a bit more scientifically.
Well, we're doing it for FX PhD, and this stuff is primarily aimed at FX PhD. FX PhD certainly is the source of, you know, the funding to do it, but the idea for PhD is that exactly that. Yeah, we do those tests when we have time properly, so that when you get a job come through the door and they say, we were going to shoot daylight, we're now shooting tungsten, what do you want me to do? You go, actually, it doesn't make any difference, or actually, you really should correct, or you should increase your light levels, or whatever. And you know, there is an IRE meter in the actual Red, so you can spot meter with it, which we were doing. I just, you know, the end of the day, and you know, this is just fun filming, right? I mean, it almost doesn't matter what it is, but it's particularly fun filming when you're not like burning money and freaking out with, you know.
Makes it more of a hobby thing than an actual sort of
we hadn't got
job.
An entire set of, like, you know, we shoot with kinoflows a lot because I just like them.
Mm.
So we got an entire set of tungsten kinoflows and daylights so that we could have exactly the same lighting sets and 100% switch them between tungsten and daylight without, you know, going, well, hang on, that was on HMIs and that was on, you know, whatever. But, yeah, it was great. It was really fun. Pete's a good DOP, too.
Excellent. And what we will be doing, as I say, next year when things probably will slow down a little bit for Red in between while we're waiting for machines to ship, that we will... I think just before a couple of weeks ago, you sort of sent a Twitter out, and we sort of asked people what do they want to see and what do they want to hear about in Red Center. And what came back, a lot of what responses that we got were workflow.
Yeah, yeah. I think both are needed, and I think we can walk that line between providing good workflow solutions, like John's discussion of the AE, and you know, sensible practical stuff on set, like your stuff with the with the sky. Sun positioning stuff, which quite frankly was, you know, black art until you explained it.
It's very simple, but keep it to yourself.
Well, you say that, right? But, you know,
well, you know, you want to sort of keep up the mystery as much as possible. It sort of seem, yeah. It's all about sort of making it seem like a bit of alchemy that, oh, wow, fantastic DP.
Now, that's getting a good performance out of an actor. That's alchemy. All right.
That's luck.
Please travel safe during the holidays. Thank you so much for supporting us. I mean, we've been really kind of knocked over with the support we've had of the show this year. Once they join, we're going to do this once a fortnight and, you know, keep the numbers considerably lower. But we had such good response, such great listener feedback. So I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour, and you're on Twitter as
Wingrove.
So that's a good way to talk to us, or just post stuff on FX Guide. There's a link to the site, as well as, of course, the show notes. And the show notes this week will include not only the stuff that we've got links to, but photos of that gear and photos showing the diagrams of the sunlight stuff, the sun path. So, yeah, and if you are somebody that has some stuff that you'd like us to look at, we're currently doing some testing with some gear that we have like in the evaluation stage, I guess would be the best way to put it. We've got a bunch of Element Technica stuff in the lab at the moment that we're testing, and we're very comfortable running stuff through its paces and giving feedback. But until next week, which will in fact be after the Christmas break, have a happy Christmas, Jase.
Same to you, Mike. Thank you. Thanks for the year. It's been great.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.